This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. A replacement for NAFTA, Brexit, tariffs, a trade war, China. There is so much going on with global trade, it can be kind of hard to wrap your head around it all. Now, many of us are pretty insulated from the direct impacts of trade disruptions, so it can be easy to lose sight of what's at stake. That's why today we're looking at global trade through local eyes. It's part of our new project called 1A Across America. We're bringing voices to the nation that rarely get heard. After the break, we'll hear from miners in northern Minnesota, people who work in a mine, about what it feels like to live in a one-industry town and how trade decisions in Washington are affecting them there. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
Today we visit northern Minnesota. It's home to an iron ore mining region called the Iron Range. It's mined for taconite, which is an ore that's used in steel. Many of the people who live in the Iron Range are like Cliff Toby. He's a third-generation miner. His grandmother worked the mines during World War II.
She was a widow with four or five kids. And back then they didn't have any kind of social safety net, so you know, she had to go to work in order to survive, and that's what she did as like a 20-some-year-old widow.
Our producer spoke with Toby and other miners last week about U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods, namely steel. We also spoke with Joe Fredrickson, Chris Johnson, and John Arbogast. They are all presidents of their local United Steelworkers Union chapters, representing roughly 2,500 iron miners in northern Minnesota. Here's how they described life on the Iron Range.
It's mining or bust up here, so I've been laid off from our facility a handful of times in the 23 years I've been there, and it's not a pretty sight when it happens. It affects from McDonald's to Target to the car dealer.
I just wanted to add one thing to that. Joe had talked about, you know, the effects that it has on all the dealerships and all the different things. But there's really a human toll that a lot of people probably don't see. For instance, I had one member who committed suicide during the time that we were down. You know, you lose your income, things can really, you know, go in a downward spiral. We see a lot of divorces. We see a lot of alcoholism. We see a lot of those things that go with these kinds of downturns. And I just didn't want that to be, you know, looked past because, these people really, you know, they suffer a lot when these industries go into those kind of a situation. And it's the saddest part is it's really through no fault of our own. You know what I mean? We're here, we want to work, we want to produce. And, you know, these other countries and our trade laws and all the politics that go with it a lot of times come in and sweep the rug out from underneath us. And it really can have a devastating effect on people's lives, you know.
A lot of times you'll have a father and a son working at the same place. So when they're laid off, the whole family feels it. Grandkids, kids, everybody feels it. So, you know, when we do end up laying off, it sends shockwaves through the community. It really does. The local grocery stores, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, big cities that, you know, have these chain stores. We're talking about local people that own these businesses, local banks, local, I mean, everybody feels it. Yeah, you know, the state gives you, you know, unemployment and you make do with what you can, but it doesn't cover everything.
We'll keep hearing the voices of these Minnesota steelworkers, Cliff Toby, Chris Johnson, and John Arbogast, in just a moment. Let's add one more voice to our discussion to add a little context to what we're hearing from northern Minnesota. Joining us now is Sean Donnan, a senior writer at Bloomberg News. Sean, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Seems like it was only a few days ago that we were speaking, and it was only a few days ago, and part of what we were discussing then are some of these global trade moves, and I'm glad we get to localize this a bit. What's your sense, Sean, of how many Americans are living in places like the Iron Range in Minnesota, where there really is one game in town, and that one game determines everyone's fate?
Well, the answer is there's millions of Americans who are living in communities that are dependent on a single factory or a single company. And it's a pattern that we've seen pretty much through the 20th century and continue into the 21st century. I think, you know, one of the stories of clearly of the last couple of decades has been the impact of China on not just the U.S. economy, but on local economies around the United States. And that gets into what those economies are tied to. There was a real landmark study a few years ago by an economist at MIT called David Autor, who documented and went back through the decades and documented what he called the China shock, and found that essentially it had meant a loss of 2.5 million jobs over a period of time in U.S. manufacturing, and a lot of it was localized in zip codes. You could identify specific industries like the steel industry, like the furniture industry, like the textile industry that really had just been unable to compete with this new juggernaut on the global economy in China.
Let's pick up our conversation with the miners, particularly their thoughts on the tariff war. Here is some of what the guys in the Iron Range told us about how tariffs affect them.
When you watch the news and you watch the press and you see these people talking about these tariffs, I think people get lost in the fact that we started with the steel and aluminum tariff, okay? We believe that those tariffs were 100% justified. For decades, we've watched as these other countries have manipulated their currency. They've illegally dumped. They've illegally subsidized. They've done all these illegal things. They've not played by the rules of our trade agreements. Okay, so we think those are justified. Now, you might go to some of these steel users who want that cheap steel. They want that illegally dumped steel because it improves their profit margins. We don't agree with that. These same places that are screaming that they don't want these tariffs because it's bringing steel prices to where steel prices naturally should be under the trade agreements, they would be the first ones in line trying to get tariffs if they were over here dumping cars, if they're over here dumping other things that are made out of steel. They certainly wouldn't want China subsidizing those things and doing the same thing to their business that they're doing to the steel industry. So that's something that people should keep in mind. We're not asking for handouts or anything like that. We're just asking to enforce our trade laws and our trade agreements.
Well, and you have to look at the tariffs. I mean, on a $50,000 truck, it's going up, you know, a little less than $1,000. Well, if you're going to spend $50,000 for a pickup truck, you know, $1,000 isn't going to, you know, change your mind whether you're going to purchase that vehicle or not. A beer can, a pop can goes up, you know, a fraction of a penny. It's a lot of fear mongering that other people are in the press saying that these tariffs are destroying. We've been in a trade war for over 30 years. Someone, and we give them credit, someone finally stood up for us.
And a lot of us are waiting to see what kind of deal he made with China now, you know, that he came back and we'll see if he's sticking to his word now. Who knows, you know? We don't know. That's the problem. One tweet and everything changes and that affects us.
Sean Donnan, let's pick back up with you and two issues that the miners raised in that clip. The first is this question about what happens next with China. We're kind of in this holding pattern for now with these 25% tariffs in place. No new tariffs are kicking in anytime soon. Do we have any idea what might be coming next?
We don't know where this is going directly, but we've had some encouraging signs in the last couple of days or the last 10 days or so that really things are at least calming down a little bit in the Chinese trade war. So if you go back to December 1st in Buenos Aires, President Trump had dinner with Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, and they kind of hashed out a truce in the trade wars there, whereby Donald Trump agreed not to raise tariffs on some $200 billion in Chinese imports that were due to go from 10% to 25% on January 1st. And in exchange, the Chinese agreed to resume some purchases of soybeans, maybe lower tariffs on cars that are imported into China from the U.S., and kind of de-escalate, if you will, the trade war. That takes us back to where we were 6 months ago, though, and it doesn't remove some of the bigger issues that are there between the world's two largest economies, and those are going to be the subject of negotiations that are going to take us through probably March 1st. That's what the president has set as a deadline for these talks, and may go beyond that because these are really complicated issues.
The second issue that the miners raised in this last clip is the impact on steel users like the auto industry. GM will be idling 5 plants, mostly in the U.S., also some in Canada. Trade, it seems to come down to this game of chess where you're always going to be sacrificing one worker for another. I mean, is it even possible to make these kind of moves without hurting somebody?
Right. So the argument for a long time here in the United States has been that it's best to let the market decide these things. That any time a government tries to pick one industry over another as a winner, it just kind of has this procession of unintended consequences that kind of ripple through the economy and that can hurt the economy overall. And that's kind of what we've seen so far in this trade war. So back earlier this year in the spring, the president announced these tariffs on steel and aluminum on national security grounds, arguing that steel was a vital component of the U.S. economy, vital to the economic security of the United States, and wanted to insulate it from protect it from competition from overseas, much of which had stopped coming from China, to be honest, because there had been a procession of more targeted tariffs that had started in the Obama administration. Actually, you can go back decades in terms of the tariffs that have been put on the steel industry. But we've seen a whole series of retaliatory measures by China, the right. EU, and others, and that has started to flow through. And like you say, GM has seen up to $1 billion in costs from this.
We'll pick this up in just a moment with Sean Donnan of Bloomberg News. We'll hear more from those steel workers in northern Minnesota, those iron ore miners, and we'll get to some more of your comments as well. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from CLR Bath & Kitchen. Which two rooms in your house get the most use? If you said the kitchen and the bathroom, you're not alone. And keeping these rooms clean is a never-ending job. CLR Bath & Kitchen makes it easy. Its fast-acting spray makes everything sparkle and gleam, from faucets and shower doors to porcelain and stainless steel, without phosphates, ammonia, or bleach. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. Trust CLR Bath & Kitchen, making the world a little cleaner. Looking for the perfect gift for the public radio and podcast nerds in your life? NPR t-shirts, caps, totes, mugs, pet products, toys, and puzzles are just waiting to be checked off your holiday shopping list at shop.npr.org.
Let me get to a few of your comments before we hear back from our friends in Minnesota. P. Edward Murray tweeted, "Once upon a time, we mined our own iron to create our own American-made steel. I don't understand why we can't do that again. We should be exporting American steel, not importing it." Sean Donnan, could you respond to that tweet? What is the balance like right now in terms of steel from and to the U.S.?
So the U.S. is the world's largest steel importer right now, and it exports very little steel. And part of the reason for that is over a number of decades, the U.S. steel industry has become, on a global basis, uncompetitive. It just isn't able to keep up with not just Chinese producers, and they've become the big juggernaut in the global steel industry in the last decade or so, but South Korean producers, Japanese producers, even some European producers. You know, the steel industry it's heavy stuff. A lot of it isn't moved around the world as much as you would think. The U.S. steel industry now operates at about 70% capacity or so. It's one of the goals of these tariffs that Donald Trump has introduced is to raise that capacity and to try and bring new steel online. But really what's happened so far is that we've seen a kind of idled plants come back into service. And one of the big concerns that analysts have is that a lot of these plants are actually old plants that aren't hugely competitive, that aren't the kind of highly automated plants that you see internationally that are going to be competitive in the longer run. So it might be a short-term band-aid that we see with these tariffs rather than a long-term fix for a steel industry that for decades has been struggling to be competitive internationally.
And I think if we're honest, you know, a lot of the growth in our economy, as you mentioned, you know, a lot of these factories are older. We are, you know, still producing a great deal in manufacturing, but we're doing it with far fewer people. I get the sense that our economy today has more to do with using steel to build new towers and buildings and corporate campuses to create the high-tech innovations of the future, which are businesses that scale in a very different way than exporting a physical product like steel.
Absolutely. And you know, this is a long-run trend that cheap steel has helped fuel other industries, but it's come at a cost. So in Ohio, for example, in 1990, there were almost 35,000 people working in iron and steel mills. There are now roughly 7,500 people working in those steel mills. That's not a long-term trend that is going to change. And a lot of that has to do with automation and the efficiency of mills, not just in Ohio, and if you open a steel mill today, you're going to need a lot less people to run it, but internationally, and whether those old mills can keep up. And there's a big question for the U.S. economy as to whether or not it wants to get back into that basic manufacturing game, or mm-hmm. whether it wants to go further up the value chain. And for a long time, the argument has been, you know, let's focus on innovation, let's focus on the future industries, and let's take advantage of the kind of globalization of supply chains, which allows us to do things more efficiently overseas.
Lots of comments about the president's trade policies, of course. Dan wrote on our Facebook page, tariffs are a tax paid to the government. So all of these supporters of Trump who hate taxes are being hypocritical, full stop. The economy is global and complicated, and our president is doing what he always does, using a sledgehammer where a surgical knife is needed. Alan emailed, for once President Trump was right. The Chinese have long been cheating on trade agreements and eating our lunch, but Trump went about it wrong. He should have gotten the backing of our allies instead of insulting them. This might be a good place to pick up our conversation with those iron ore miners in northern Minnesota, their local union presidents, and they are active members of the Democratic Party. But they say they're seeing growing support for President Trump and the GOP among their members.
Being at my property for, you know, the last, you know, 13, 14 years, I saw more Republican stickers and signs than I've ever seen.
They're talking like what the old Democrats used to talk like. They're talking, they're giving the steelworker messages of, you know, jobs, you know, and I really think that they've done a good job at that, and the Democrats have really just been standing around watching, and they've been focusing way too much on the social issues, and if they don't take a step back and look at that, I think they're going to have problems in 2020.
They were very smart. They stole our message and they used it, and our people listened to it. We're gonna mine. We support jobs. We support common sense, environmental rule. They stole our handbook. And it worked.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, we were in the middle of a campaign as steelworkers to try and stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and Hillary Clinton was against it, and she was for it, and Trump came out and said, if on day one, when I'm elected, I'm going to get rid of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and he did.
And we had already stopped it.
Now he's talking about scrapping NAFTA, which, you know, I mean, We see some wrong things with NAFTA also. So again, he's jumping on what we're already pushing against, and it's, you know, they're not wrong. You know, they're saying everything that our members have heard from us.
We've been mad for decades. We've been mad at Bill Clinton ever since he signed NAFTA because it was a terrible trade deal, and now Trump's rewriting it. So Democrats are leaving the party and heading over to the red.
If the Republicans, if there was any playbook that they could use, if they got off that high horse of that they demand right to work, and if they started doing a pro-union message, the Democrat Party would have a huge problem. That is the only thing hanging on in Minnesota, and that's why Minnesota stays Democrat.
Before we continue with our conversation from Northern Minnesota, Sean Donnell, let me come back to you. There's a lot to unpack there, particularly, you know, the unions, trade deals, the steelworkers don't like NAFTA. They're skeptical of this new NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. They say it will move money around between company owners, do little for workers. What about this political shift from Democrats to Republicans? What do we read into that, particularly as it relates to the future of resolving these disputes?
I think there's two big questions there. The first is this change that we're seeing on the Republican side simply a change that's about Donald Trump and therefore potentially a fleeting change in attitudes towards trade in the Republican Party? If I go up to Capitol Hill now and I go talk to people on the House and the Senate side, Republicans up there, you know, they tend to still be very pro-trade and very pro-trade agreements, and they're kind of biting their tongue now as Donald Trump is pursuing the trade policy that he is. But we are seeing a flip in the base, and polls show that Republicans now have become, Republican voters have become much more skeptical of trade agreements, and Democratic voters are become much more gung-ho. They tend to be younger. They tend to be much more gung-ho about things like globalization and NAFTA. Overall, in a funny way, NAFTA is more popular than it's ever been in the United States, and it's hard to disentangle that from politics, whether part of that is because Donald Trump, who has a very low approval rating, opposes it and so on. But, the politics are clearly of the politics of trade. Have clearly been scrambled by Donald Trump. And that gets into part of the 2020 equation, the big 2020 question for a lot of Democrats who want to seize trade back as an issue to try and get some of those voters that you're talking to there in the Iron Range and in Rust Belt states like Ohio back on board. And they see trade as a big message. And that's one of the reasons you hear a lot of Democrats talk about Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, who's a long-term trade skeptic, mentioned as a kind of gravel-voiced candidate for 2020.
Scott emailed, so increased cost doesn't affect consumers' behavior at all? Is it only harmful to make things more expensive when talking about environmental regulations? Scott, glad you brought that up because the iron miners brought that up as well. And depending on who you ask, in their view, environmental regulations might be a bigger threat than cheap Chinese goods. Here's what they told us.
You know, sometimes it feels like you're choosing between a gun and a knife, you know what I mean? These imports are always a threat, you know what I mean? As the wind blows and as the tweets go, I guess we'll find out how those are going to come out, but these overzealous environmental regulations could be the downfall up here if cooler heads don't overcome, you know.
Well, and I can tell you for my own facility, we put big money into, you know, cutting pollution and doing it safely and environmentally safe, where you look at a place like China, they don't do it near like we do. Yeah, they said that they put some regulations on them now, but they haven't. I mean, anybody can see it. Around here, we can walk around without masks. There, they can't. We have to put money into that. So it's a burden on our company to do that. We think it's a good thing they do it, but it should be fair across the board.
I don't want it to sound like we're trying to get a selfish message out there that we're just worried about mining and me filling my pocketbook with mining cash. We don't. We still back all these environmental rules. We don't like the over usage of an environmental rule or the abuse, just like we don't like abuse in trade. We're pro-trade, we're not free trade, and we're pro-environment. We're not so far that we think the mine should be closed.
Kind of like you said, you're choosing a gun or a knife. I mean, you know, if the trade doesn't get fixed, there's no reason for environmental regulations because we're going to be shut down anyway.
We have a very difficult time telling miners to support a party that's trying so hard to become fundamentally anti-mining. It's really, it puts you in between a rock and a hard place, but, you know, it's like you say, it's very conflicting, at least for me, in that sense. You know, I mean, that doesn't mean I'm running over to the other side and going to support a party who's platform is basically to destroy unions and privatize Social Security and do all those things that would hurt working people. But sometimes it kind of leaves you wishing you had a third choice, you know.
Sean, what about this idea that environmental regulations are also threatening the jobs of some folks who feel like they're just kind of caught in the middle? The idea supposedly was that by updating the way we do business in a more eco-friendly way, it would create new jobs, but it's not creating jobs in the Iron Range, so it would seem.
Yeah, and this is, you know, again, it's complicated. One of the Donald Trump's key economic platforms has been a pursued deregulation, and environmental regulations have been a key part of that. But, you know, we also need to keep in mind the global context here, and that is that, yes, China for years has had much laxer environmental standards than it has had than the United States, and that it has used that in part as a competitive advantage in terms of manufacturing and so on. But we've also seen a big shift in China in the last few years towards more stricter environmental standards, partly because they're dealing with some of the same issues that the U.S. was dealing with in the 1970s and when the environmental movement was kind of awoken here. You know, some of us are old enough to remember those stories about smog in L.A. you know, the Love Canal stories and so on. And China's had its own kind of Love Canal and smog moment. You know, the air pollution in Beijing is intense. It's a big, it really affects the lives of, and the health of the people there. And so China has been flipping. And one of the things it's been doing is focusing a lot more on sustainable energy and the kind of 21st century industries that we should, like electric vehicles. You know, China is about to become a juggernaut in the electric vehicle world. Already it is a juggernaut in terms of producing lithium-ion batteries, which are one of the key elements of an electric vehicle, obviously. Yeah. And that future advantage is something that the U.S. needs to be looking at as well.
A few more comments before we wind down. Jet tweeted, tariffs have directly affected me, and I'm not wringing my hands about a $50,000 truck. We bought our forever home with intent to restore, and now tariffs have slowed us down considerably. Also worth noting that not everyone is terribly sympathetic to the folks that we're speaking to on the Iron Range. Joanne emailed, no one is mentioning the elephant in the room. Why do American steel mills not innovate, update equipment? And Curtis tweeted, where do you think ghost towns come from? Everyone knows what a ghost town is. Why are we agonizing over ghost towns today? If you are living in a ghost town, you need to relocate. Sean, we did a program in Minnesota last year that explores the relationship between industries like mining and tourism, and the miners we spoke to say they can't make a living earning what they estimated was $7 an hour as an environmental tour guide. Is this one of those situations where you have to either kind of evolve or go extinct? I mean, what's the future look like for these guys?
Well, I think, you know, that question of moving, which has been a huge part of the American story for, you know, going back to pioneer days, to move in pursuit of opportunity is a very real thing. I think we often associate trade and the impact of globalization with things that are actually the result of technological change or evolution. They're also the result of just internal competition. I've spent a lot of time in my life in New England and Massachusetts peaked as a manufacturing power in the 1880s. And there's a lot of empty mill towns in Massachusetts that have turned into different things. You know, Lowell, Massachusetts, from whence Jack Kerouac came, was a gritty, deindustrializing city into the 1960s and 70s. It's now part of a kind of biotech and tech belt around Boston. You know, that is the hard thing for communities. There are some that are good at adapting, and there are some that are just never going to adapt. And that's always the hard question for people in those communities. When do you stay? When do you go? And it's just not clear that that hard question, those hard trends are going to change anytime soon.
Sean Donnan, senior writer for Bloomberg News. Sean, thanks for helping us make sense of what's going on, and thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks also to the steelworkers who hosted our Across America team in northern Minnesota, Cliff Toby, Chris Johnson, Joe Fredrickson, and John Arbogast. Thanks also to Minnesota Public Radio, one of the six stations we've partnered with on this project. You can learn more about 1A Across America and the team that produced it, James Morrison and Amanda Williams, online at the1a.org/AcrossAmerica. And this project is funded by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.